Welcome, everybody, to this post-PGA Tour season and pre-Ryder Cup edition of Jay Flemma Sports Report on Golf News Net, Radio Network, and iHeartRadio. I am Jay Flemma, and I guess instead of hello and welcome, I should be saying bienvenidos, and I'll tell you why. You know how I like to joke around sometimes that, hey, we're coming at you live from our super secret laboratory miles beneath the Earth's crust? Well, this time we're coming at you from our high Erie camp, 10,000 feet above sea level, deep in the Andes Mountains of Patagonia, South America. And it's not a joke. I've been sent here on skiing assignment. Two different magazines to write different stories about two of the greatest ski areas in the world, and a cat skiing adventure deep, deep, deep into the Andes Mountains, completely in the wild. It's going to be a fantastic show. We're really excited. It's our first international broadcast. And as they say in the infomercials, but wait, there's more. We are first time ever being recorded before a live studio audience. And on top of that, we'd like to thank other special guests of ours, the GE Ski Club of Utica, New York, who are tuning in for their first meeting of the season. So welcome to ski season, and I hope everybody had a great golf season. I have to tell you, I have taken the trip of a lifetime here. I'm absolutely over the moon with how beautiful this place is, how terrific the skiing is, and it's all because of an outfit called Savor the Journey. These folks specialize in trips around the world for culinary adventures and athletic adventures. And here to tell us all about all the terrific places that they visited and fantastic things they do is their founder, owner, operator, Aaron Schorsch. Aaron, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Jay. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the who, what, when, where, these purposes.
Yeah. So I started Savor the Journey about 7.5 years ago. And it was sort of the culmination of a bunch of things that I like to do and skills that I have. Basically, at my root, I am a foodie. And I think about food. I talk about food. I dream about food. I cook food. I eat food all the time. And I sort of had the idea for this company. I was living in France, and I was working on an organic vegetable farm, and I was selling at farmers markets in France and meeting all kinds of cool food producers, butchers, bakers, cheesemakers, no candlestick makers. And I then came back to the U.S. After living there for a year, after this really rich experience, and I started working at a really good farm-to-table restaurant. I was working there as a chef. And they were closed during the winter because it was on a farm. And I went back to France and set up a bunch of little internships for myself with all these food producers that I knew. And I was just blown away by how welcoming they were and willing they were to show me their craft. And so I spent about 6 weeks doing internships doing that. And when I came back, I had all these very jealous friends who were like, could you set me up an experience like that? In France with your connections? And I was like, no, you know, you need to be able to speak the language and you have to be somebody. I was already a known entity in that community. And somebody was like, what if you were sort of that key to get a group in? You know, you sort of facilitated that. And that sounded reasonable. So I went back to France and sort of ran it by all my friends there and all the connections I had. And they were, most of them were like, well, you know, we're not really set up to do kind of touristy things like that. But if you want to bring a group here, that sounds like fun. Let's do it. And so we did the first one in 2016. That was a culinary one. And with a group of 10 people, sort of a trial run. It was a great success. We had excellent hosted meals and learned all kinds of stuff and had a lot of fun. And then because that was so encouraging, I started adding other experiences in France. So I added a skiing and snowboarding and cheese theme trip. I like to call it a cheese trip with a ski problem. And so basically we ski all day and then eat cheese and drink wine for a good part of the evening anyway. But just really trying to sort of tie in the food of an area, the culture, The adventure, which on some of these trips is skiing, some of them I do is fly fishing, some of them are straight sort of culinary, but there's always hiking or bicycling or something of that nature. I like to be active. I like to experience not only the people and the cuisine, but also the geography and the sort of natural landscapes of a place. And so France was sort of my stronghold. That's where I had a lot of connections. But I also lived for a year in Sweden while my wife was doing her dissertation research up above the Arctic Circle. So I started running a fly fishing trip up there. And as the trips became more popular, I had more clients that were enjoying them and they were asking for new locations. And so I started using connections that I had to develop other trips to other places. All the trips I do are ones that I really want to do. So I really wanted to do a ski trip to Japan because Japan, Hokkaido has amazing snow and amazing food. And so I searched and searched for years and finally found some connections that were able to help me set up that trip. And we've been doing that one for, this will be the fifth year now, running this trip to Argentina. This is the second year doing that. And then some trips to Italy, culinary trips. And last year we did a ski trip. Some trips in the U.S. as well with Victor and Kelly McNeil of Eagle Cat Mountain Guides, doing a backcountry hut trip. And sort of always looking at developing new trips and new experiences that fit with what I'm trying to do. And basically that's like having a really strong connection in that area. You know, I want to be able to provide experiences that people can't get if they just showed up there.
Perhaps nothing speaks more highly of the success of Savor the Journey than you've got incredible repeat business, including one fellow who's been, by his count, on 16 different trips on 4 different continents. Let's talk right now about South America. This particular trip, we've hit the largest of their wonderful ski areas, Catedral Altos Patagonia. We've also hit one of their, some would call it a hidden gem. I wouldn't exactly, because it's well known down here in South America, called Chapelco. And a little bit about cat skiing in the Baguales National Forest.
Yeah, so what we do when we look for places to run these trips is, you know, trying to satisfy several things. We want a place that has great skiing and often has varied terrain. So most of my trips for skiers are sort of intermediate and above level. So we want stuff that has diversity in terms of the slopes. Also, a growing part of the business is giving people the opportunity to do side country, so lift access backcountry or even straight backcountry. So resorts that we can slip out of gates or get into some sort of out of bounds territory where our high mountain guides can take people, or just proximity to good backcountry. Then we also want it to be near something. I mean, there are resorts that are just very sort of out on their own. But we want it to sort of be integrated into the culture a little bit more, whether that's a village or a town or, I mean, in the case of Bariloche, like a small city, so that you can get to experience some of that culture. I mean, we know you can go ski all around the world, and if you're not careful, you really don't end up learning too much about the place. And it's always my goal on these trips to give people a sense of place so that they understand that area. They understand the people a little bit, just everything that makes it. Because I think at the end, 10 years, if you ask somebody, you know, what was this trip to Argentina like? Yeah, you might remember a run or two, but it's going to be more the asado that you had or the chocolate or, you know, the people you met or the Malbecs you drank or whatever. You know, you can ski probably a lot closer to where you are. We travel to these international places to get these other experiences. And so we're searching out places where, you know, those are easy to accomplish and they're strong.
Now, you in particular, you mentioned our excellent guides, Kelly and Victor McNeil, and of course, Juan Barros. Everyone should understand that these trips are wide enough for people from super expert right on down to inexperienced but willing to learn skiers, because there's all levels. The guides in particular are superb. They're from Eagle Mountain Cap and go through a significant amount of training. Tell us a little bit about the deep and broad training that the guides go through.
Yeah, so I use, for my trips, I use sort of two different sort of professional ski instructors or guides. So I use ski instructors. These are usually certified in their country. And they are people who are really good at teaching skiing. They have a high level of expertise in the place where we're going. But their focus is mostly resort-based or a little bit out of bounds. Then the other guides that I use are what are called IFMGA, or the International Federation of Mountain Guide Association guides. And they undergo training to be a fully certified IFMGA guide. Like Victor McNeil, you have to be certified in skiing, alpine, and rock. So like mountaineering and also rock climbing. So these are people who can be roping you in and taking you into some really extreme stuff. These guides are the people who are scouting lines for professional skiers or taking people to the world's highest peaks. They're sort of the unicorns of the guiding world. There's only about 5,000 of them in the world. The certification is like one of the most grueling and difficult things you can do. And all of them that I've had the pleasure of working with have been really excellent. So I have grown that network in a large part because of Victor and Kelly and their connections in various countries. So I search out and use these high mountain guides on virtually all of my trips. And it makes a big difference because their training is just so exceptional. And they're so good at working with people and understanding what people need and keeping people safe. A lot of them do avalanche forecasting as well. And so that's been a big part of the success, I think, of my company, is having people like Victor who add so much value to the trip. We've had trips where people come and everybody else is like complaining about the snow that day, but the people who ski with the high mountain guide are like, oh, we had great snow all day. They're able to take into account aspect and wind and all kinds of factors to find really the best snow and the best terrain in any given location. And so that's something I recognized early on, was it made sense to pay for these really amazing guides because they just provide such an amazing experience for people, whether they're intermediate level or especially as you get up into the advanced and expert level skiers.
One of the things that I enjoyed most about this was when they laid down the ground rules, which are similar ground rules that I lay down when I go on a ski trip, like punctuality. When we say 7 o'clock, we're out the door, it's not 7:05. And things like put the darn cell phone away. How important is it when you are on a big trip to high country that everybody all be on the same page and organized and that you keep to the schedule? Because sure enough, things are going to get changed and things are going to have to adapt and you're going to have to go along with it.
Yeah, that's a great point. It's something I've learned having done these trips is I've really seen that if you lay out the rules in the beginning and you're very clear about how that's all going to work, it seems to really help the functioning of the group. And I've had groups that will get derailed on various things, but you can bring them back to remember how we talked about, punctuality, and that, people want to get out the door. And I don't care too much if you're just somebody who's generally not punctual. You need to figure out how to get there on time. And it just helps the group function smoothly. One of our goals as leaders of these trips is to take a group of people, 10 people who don't really know each other, and bring them all together into some cohesive team. Because we're going to be together for about 9 days. We're going to be living under the same roof. I mean, I think my trips are a little different in that we often stay in these big chalets or villas, and we're all under the same roof. We're eating breakfast together. It's not that people have their own little room, and then they're coming down, to a hotel breakfast room or something. So it's a little bit more intimate in that way, which when it works is really great. But you do have to sort of set out rules as to how that's going to function. And I was lucky enough during some of my wilderness leadership training to work with some really amazing instructors, and those sort of soft skills and getting groups to come together and function well was a really big focus of that training. And I felt that that's really, really helped with the groups that I've had, getting them to work together. And even people who, have very different backgrounds and maybe different thoughts, but you can still get them together for a week to have a really enjoyable time. And when it works right, it's great. People really enjoy being able to work together as a team like that and have it be a little maybe less formal than some of the other places, a little more familial. You can just come back and lay on a couch and drink some wine, and maybe you take a nap and nobody's going to be that worried about it. But you have the social aspect there sort of whenever you want it. We also, everybody has their own rooms as well, so you do have a place to go back to when you need to decompress a little. But I think having everyone under one roof is really important.
You mentioned the word team, which is critical, because when you all come together of different people from different walks of life and different experiences, all of which seem to be superlative, you get a chance to see other aspects of the world that you never saw before. The learning experience on one of your trips, not just in terms of the culture, but in terms of the people that you're with, that's one of the greatest gifts as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it's something I've really enjoyed is hearing stories of people who've been on my trips who then go and visit other people that they met on the trip. Oh, yeah, we took a road trip across the country and we went to Victoria, BC and met up with so-and-so. It's cool. I love that, connecting these people together. And yeah, sometimes, you don't have to be with somebody that long to hit it off and have a really great experience. And find somebody that you might become friends with for a long time to come.
Why Catedral Altos Patagonia? Tell the world what is so special about this particular area.
Yeah, well, I think it's got several things going for it. One, it's quite a large ski area, and as
the largest in South America.
Yeah. And it's got reasonably new infrastructure, so things work pretty well and smoothly, and the lifts are pretty fast. It also has the proximity to Bariloche, which is an interesting city and has this rich sort of Alpine European history with lots of chocolate and sort of even some of the architecture from like Switzerland and Austria. It has great access to the side country, and more specifically the refugio, so the huts that we run like a small extension after this trip, that's all human powered, so backcountry skiing. And the refugio Frey is one of the famous ones in Patagonia, and it's a beautiful stone hut in this really cool cirque with great skiing all around, and they cook really good food for you. So I think all those things, sort of combine to make a great place. There's, other excellent places in Argentina as well. We picked, Bariloche. Also, it's a bit, it's a little farther south than some of the places in Chile, or Las Leñas. So we're dealing with climate change and climate instability, and things are warming. So makes a little sense when I say south. Of course, we're in the southern hemisphere, so that means you're getting towards more cold, which is good. And it also has quite a good vertical. And so even if you're skiing slop at the bottom, you can be skiing really nice dry powder up top. So it's a challenge in that way too. But you've got, down, you've got tree level stuff through really pretty Lenga trees. And then you have the alpine stuff above that. And it's gorgeous. I describe it, it's most similar to Lake Tahoe of the places I've skied, where you look out on a beautiful lake, Nahualhuapi, with these islands and, the snow covered, Andes. And it's a stunning, stunning place.
It's so stunning that many pundits have said it is perhaps the single most beautiful lake view area in the world. And it's a short list that they give you. Okay, there's Wanaka in New Zealand. There's Tahoe that you mentioned. There's Mount Tremblant. But I don't think any of them compare to the stunning beauty of the Andes and Lake Nahuelhuapi. Tell us a little about Chapalco, the second area that we're visiting.
Yeah, I'm not as familiar with Chapalco. And actually, last year for the trip, we stayed the whole time at Catedral, which was great. But, you know, when we sort of debriefed the trip and thought about how we could improve it, it made sense to see if we couldn't find a place, you know, within a few hours drive that we could add a little bit more diversity to the experience. Catedral is very large, but still, if you ski there for 6 days, you know, chances are you've seen a good bit of it, especially with good visibility and weather. And so we made the decision for this year to add in Chapalco. It's about 3 hours drive from Bariloche. It's not as big, but it's also, you know, that may be an advantage in some ways. It's a little bit less known, a little bit smaller, so you can sort of get an easier grasp of it, less people, a little smaller town. So again, we're just looking for a little bit more diversity in terms of that experience that we're able to offer. And, you know, it's for these trips, I always want to provide something like you had talked about, that we have repeat customers. And so people enjoy the trip and they're willing to sign up and do the trip again. But we also like to be able to give them something new to look forward to think about, to experience. I have one lady who has come on 5 of the 7 culinary adventures that I lead to Haute Savoie. So she's come virtually every year. And the itinerary is similar, but I always change it a little bit. And she loves the things that are familiar and loves the new things. And so it keeps it fresh. And so that was our part of our decision to add Chapalco for this year.
We're talking with Aaron Shores of Savor the Journey, international traveler, culinary expert, and athlete. One of the things that I like the most about Chapalco is it is completely sustainable. It runs on its own renewable energy.
Yeah. It's really great to see people putting these things in action. I think, you know, the ski industry is a tricky one because it's so dependent on snow, which has become such a difficult thing. And, you know, I think us as skiers, when we think about being at a resort and are we part of the problem? And, you know, it's a complicated issue. Obviously, the more skiers we have and the more people who are into it, they might be more, they see more value in these places. They see more value in protecting these landscapes. But at the same time, we're doing something that is using a bunch of energy to make this all happen. So it's great when places can find a way to actually, bring in some of that sustainability. And, you know, it's always something we're striving for, and the industry should be striving for. But it's great to see that Chapalco has figured out how to do that.
Let's talk a little bit about hat skiing in the middle of nowhere in a national forest and the Bagualas Mountain Reserve. How did you find out about that? And is that not perhaps one of the most amazing trips that you offer at Savor the Journey?
Yeah. Well, that we found out about through Juan Cruz Barros, who's our Argentine local ski instructor. And he has also helped me on trips to Japan. As a funny side note, that's actually where I met him, was in Japan. He helped out with the trip there. And when I found out he was from Argentina, I started, you know, kept that in the back of my mind. And eventually when we started to develop this trip, you know, talking to him and getting him on board really was key to opening up this possibility. And so He holds a lot of that local knowledge in this area. And so he was the one who had found Baguales. And I haven't been out there, but I know that it's, I dropped people off there last year. It's, you know, you drive for an hour outside of Bariloche and drop people off in the middle of nowhere. And then they get taken up with these, like, you know, really heavy duty snow traveling pickup trucks and things with treads and stuff. And they've got this whole little lodge there where you can spend the night if you want. They've got great food. You have a chance to cat ski in this just incredibly huge untouched area with, you know, Andean condors soaring around. And, you know, cat skiing operations, they're high enough up. They're a little farther south too than Bariloche. Last year when we were here, we had some very firm snow at Catedral, and they were skiing powder at Baguales. So for the people who went on that trip, that was definitely a highlight. I like to be able to offer some of these optional different experiences, whether it's cat skiing or on the trip I run to France, we do an optional backcountry descent of the famous Vallée Blanche. These are, I don't know, for people who, you know, are making the commitment to come this far, they sometimes want to make sure they're not missing anything and they want to do everything that's possible. And so being able to provide cat skiing here, Japan is also another place that we offer that, can be a really fun experience for people.
I can vouch for the POW. At yeah. Baguales, it was anywhere from 8 inches to 2 feet. And I've been skiing for 52 years. And I have to say, okay, Baguales took me over its knee and gave me a good spanking. I never loved getting beaten up so badly so much. Tell us a little bit about what's proper preparation for taking a trip like this.
Well, there's several things that I think about. One, I think being in good shape is a good thing. And so I always recommend that, you know, people are doing exercise specific to the trip that we're doing. So for skiing, making sure that you're, you know, in good cardio shape, that your legs are strong. You know, this trip to Argentina is a little different because most people are coming from the Northern Hemisphere. So it's a little harder to be doing exercise, like skiing exercise. So you should be, you know, doing some cross training. I also tell people somewhat jokingly, you should be preparing for the eating as well, because this often happens that people will say, oh my gosh, there's so much food. I didn't know there was going to be so much food. And I tell them, you know, it's a ski trip and a culinary trip. So you should be training for the eating as well. I think having the right gear and packing correctly is a really important part of it. You know, I try and send out pretty specific lists of what to bring. And, you know, those have gotten tweaked over the years with what seems to work for people. I think it's really valuable when people can learn a little bit about the place, whether that's learning a few words in that language, if they're not familiar with the language, learning a little bit about the history. Just read, you know, sometimes there's a book that you can read that maybe it's not the full subject of the book, but that touches on it so that you sort of have some context when you arrive there. Obviously, you could just get off the airplane and not have any idea where you are and we would take care of you. But it's good if you have sort of some prior trip preparation so you know what you're going, what language is happening, and, you know, what to expect and what to sort of be on the lookout for. And, you know, at the, when we do the orientation sort of for the trip, we always get people's goals. And I think it's a really valuable thing because, you know, some people will come in and they'll say, oh, I've always wanted to do this, or I read a book about this. And, you know, is it possible for us to do that? And oftentimes we've already, you know, scheduled something like that, but, sometimes, you know, just hearing from somebody like, oh, yeah, I want to make sure that I get to experience mate or whatever, you know, it makes it a lot easier for us to do it at the beginning of the trip than at the end when people are like, oh, I really wish we had gone and done X, and hard to do it afterwards.
Yeah, I wish my Spanish was a little better. I've used a smattering of Italian as well. At times when I confuse the two, it sounds like I'm speaking Esperanto. one last question before we let you go. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about the trips that are coming up for Savor the Journey, particularly the ski trips.
Sure. I'll just touch on them real quick. So I have a culinary trip that's not skiing to Italy. The next ski trip I have is to Japan, to Hokkaido, so the northernmost island. And that takes place at the end of January. It has been sold out for about 6 months now. And the 2025 trip is half sold out as well. It's a very popular trip for people who like really deep, light powder. Japan, Hokkaido in January, or Japanuary as they call it, is you know, probably the surest bet you're going to find to get good powder. If you go for a week, 2 weeks in January, beginning of February, you will get really good snow. And the food is fantastic, and we soak in onsens every day, so the thermal baths. After that, I have a ski and snowboard trip to the French and Swiss Alps. So this is at the Porte du Soleil, which is considered, I believe, the second largest collection of ski resorts in the world, accessible under one ticket. It's 13 resorts that are interconnected in France and Switzerland. And this is the area that I was working in. And so very familiar with it. It's also, all of France is good for cheese, so is Switzerland. But this area is particularly good. The Haute-Savoie is famous for some really amazing cheeses. And so we go there, we ski, we eat cheese, you know, fresh croissant in the morning. We stay in a beautiful post and beam chalet, great skiing, backcountry options, great guides. I also have a trip with Victor and Kelly with Eagle Cat Mountain Guides at the end of February. That's in the Wallawa Mountains in Oregon. That's a hut trip, so all human powered. They've got great food. They were just up in Alaska catching salmon so that they can serve that for the trip. And Kelly's dad and mom have a farm in Wyoming, so they've got fresh beef. So you eat well there and stay in a beautiful remote area in this beautiful hut that they have. After those trips, then we start to get into more of my summer trips. So I'll have a culinary trip to the Lake Como area in Italy, and then a fly fishing one in Sweden in the end of July. So that's what my schedule is looking like.
Well, what I can tell everybody is this, that I have never seen a more beautiful place. I have never had more fun skiing. And the best thing about it was the only thing that surpassed the quality of the skiing was the quality of the people, the camaraderie, the friendliness, the kindness. I went on a skiing assignment. I came back with 10 new friends. I went on a skiing assignment. I fell in love with an entire country and its people. I know that if someone else had said that, you know, I'd say, oh, what pitiful stuff. And he's just speaking in hyperbole and exaggeration. But everybody, I hope coming from me, it makes your heart glow, because I know right now, mine sure does. We'll be back in a few minutes with Ryan Ballingy talking about the end of the Tour Championship and the Ryder Cup. You're listening to Jay Flemma Sports Report on iHeartRadio and the Golf News Net Radio Network. All right, everyone, welcome back. I am Jay Flemma, and you are listening to Jay Flemma Sports Report on the Golf News Net Radio Network and iHeartRadio. I will thank our first guest, Aaron Scorse, very much for his terrific breakdown of the ski season, which is upon us very soon, and about Argentina. And now back to golf, and we're going right straight to the top of the tree with our producer, our editor-in-chief, our owner, our publisher, our founder, Ryan Ballingy, and he's got a lot to talk about, starting with the run-up through the FedEx Cup playoffs and to Victor Hovland's victory, with a K, I guess, pun intended. And then we'll talk a little bit about the Ryder Cup. So, Ryan, welcome back to the show. Thanks for being here.
Of course, Jay. Thanks for having me on.
So let's talk not only a little bit about Victor Hovland, but let's talk about what other players you were impressed with during the FedEx Cup run-up, both our usual suspects and also some players that you're going to have an eye on for next year that might be newcomers or somebody that is going to crash the party along with the big names.
Well, I mean, I think Victor Hovland's a name that stands out. Won twice. That does not typically happen in the playoffs. We've had that happen a couple of times. And that person usually winds up winning the FedEx Cup in the end, although apologies to Camila Vijegas, who did it in 2008 and couldn't break down Vijay Singh to win the FedEx Cup that year. And what was a very different format than what we have now. But Victor Hovland obviously stood out, had a great year, won on tough tracks against great fields, did it time and time again, walks away three wins on the season, $18 million at the end of the rainbow for winning the FedEx Cup. That was great. Max Homa had a really nice playoffs, has really come on nicely in the last few months, got that first top 10 in a major at the Open Championship, and it seems like it's kind of springboarded him a little bit throughout the last couple of months, and hopefully that continues for him into his first Ryder Cup. I think I was very impressed with the story of Lucas Glover. I know that straddles the playoffs a little bit. That's not exactly all playoffs, but to win to get into the playoffs effectively from the Wyndham Championship and then do it again a week later and make a little over $5 million because of, well, right around $5 million because of that, and a little bit extra on top from the FedEx Cup and what he made in the BMW Championship. Those were really the great stories for me of the playoffs.
Lucas Glover, definitely one of the great stories of the season. His resurgence was unlooked for, but definitely welcome. As everyone recalls, he was the surprise but earnest winner of the 2009 U.S. Open at Bethpage Black, beating out the likes of Vijay Singh and Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson. It was indeed an epic victory.
Yeah, strange kind of finish for him, and strange finishing hole that year, six iron to get into the 72nd hole and win this thing. But it's a U.S. Open title. You can't take that away from him. One of the rare kind of sectional qualifiers to get through and win a U.S. Open in recent memory. So for him to kind of come back full circle, and really his career has kind of been teetering a little bit, just could not find a way to putt. He talked about how he kind of had to manage what was effectively the yips until he found this putter. The lab golf putter, the Mez, that has reinvigorated him. You can't seem to miss with it, or at least he's putting a whole hell of a lot better with it. And that's a pretty cool story for a guy that has been around a long time, has been a bit of a survivor, and now kind of has the leeway to get himself to almost to the Champions Tour on his own terms.
It's wonderful to see a shot maker play so well and consistently play so well in this age of bomb and gouge golf as well. Let's throw three more names out there, though, that I was particularly interested in, and so were the fans. Rory McIlroy, it was wonderful to see him have a strong season like this. Yes, he did not win a major, but he gave us a lot to cheer for and a lot to build on for next year. Scottie Scheffler, again, strong year, didn't win a major, but again, he's definitely one of our premier players. And also Colin Morikawa, it was nice to see after a little bit of a blip on the radar screen, a bit of a, I hate to use the word, slump, but he definitely was not playing at his very best consistently for all four rounds, but he started to resurge as well. Give us your thoughts on those three players.
Sure. Yeah. McIlroy, great year. I mean, he doesn't win. I mean, same with Scheffler. They don't win as often as their talent indicates they probably should. But a lot of things have to go your way to win. It's not just being the best player. It's not just being the best putter. It's not just being the best ball striker. I mean, just ask Scottie Scheffler what it's like being the best ball striker and also having effectively a brick on a stick for a putter. It's kind of hard to win when they don't go in the hole. And that is a very strange thing to talk about, given that his season historically was one of the best ever from tee to green. I mean, we've had the shot link for 20 years. And the only guy that had the season even comparable to his once was Tiger Woods, who did it four or five times. And Scottie Scheffler kind of cracked the top three of what it means to have an elite tee to green season and won twice. Didn't get a whole lot out of it. So there has to be some concern there that the putter is kind of just betraying what his best years may be. But hopefully that's not the case. And then Rory McIlroy, same thing. Great, great year, consistent player, practically a lock for the top 15, gets in the top 10, top five so often, continues to contend in majors. One day, the law of averages is going to work in his favor. He's going to knock one down and going to go win another major championship. And like you said, Colin Morikawa had a really nice year. Unfortunately, that meltdown to start the year in Hawaii didn't work out in his favor. It worked out in John Rahm's favor. It might have been the springboard for Rahm to win the Masters in the end, but Morikawa is a really, really good player. Same kind of unfortunate curse as Scottie Scheffler and Rory McIlroy, which is a streaky putter. And I think that's true of a lot of our great players. There aren't a whole lot of great putters that are streaky from tee to green. We don't have too many of them. Just in an era of power, you have to be a great, powerful player that either hits the ball really far and wedges it pretty tight, or is just very strong from tee to green, like Colin Morikawa is. And you hope the putter works. And that's the way golf is going to work. It's going to be frustrating for a lot of golf fans for a long time to love their player of choice and just have to rely on them to find the right week with the putter to be able to win. But that is the age in which we are in.
It's part of the alchemy of golf, okay? You have to trust your swing. You have to trust your putting stroke. As you said, some days they're all going to go in and it's going to be a magical day. And some days they just aren't going to drop for you. You know, you just have to hope that you put it together at the right time. Now, Lucas Glover put it together at the right time, but I believe that most people that have a complaint, if they have one, about the Ryder Cup team is that they thought that he earned his way on it. But why don't you walk us through 1 through 12, your thoughts on the strength of the United States team and how you think they will do in Rome against the Europeans?
Well, I think both the American side and the European side has a very strong top half. And then that's not really hard to say for either team. I mean, on the European side, you've got McIlroy, you've got Rahm, got Hovland. I mean, those are kind of your clear top three. On the American side, got Scheffler, you've got Homa, you've got Morikawa. I mean, you've got some really strong players up top. You got Koepka, who's a strong player, great match player. But then you start to realize both sides have liabilities about the second half, and whether that's an experience problem, whether that's a youth problem, I don't know. But I don't think there's a 1-12 on either side where you go, all right, they're way better than the other. There are liabilities on both sides. And so I think the Americans
point two.
I think the Americans thought that after 2021, the same dozen dudes that showed up at Whistling Straits and demolished an aging European team would just keep doing the same thing for the next decade and a half. And it turns out we have about half the team turnover from just 2 years ago. So that theory goes out the window. And I think there's a core of Americans that will be around for a while. I don't think that's going anywhere. But there's going to be fluctuation, especially the way that this system was set up for players that won a major to effectively get in automatically because they got double points. And so happened that it was Wyndham Clark and Brian Hartman, two guys who put lights out, are going to be a part of this team. I think there will be a positive addition, particularly in the alternate shot format.
They are hot right now, and they're putting well right now, and that's what you want.
And Wyndham Clark represented himself very well after winning the Open. I think he sensed a disrespect about what he accomplished, whether it was the venue, whether it was who he beat for second, or Rory McIlroy, whatever it was. And I think he's carried that forward to his benefit. And Brian Harmon's a guy who's not hard to get a chip on his shoulder. Just give him about 2 or 3 minutes and talk about a couple things. Brooks Koepka's the same way. I think those guys can be quite motivated by perceived slights, real, you know, slights real and imagined. And I think that gives them a good chance in Europe. But Luke Donald's no dummy. He knows what the Americans have. They have power in spades. So he's going to try and limit that with a setup that pinches the fairways at Marco Simone and probably tries to replay a little bit of what happened in 2018 in Paris, where frustrated the Americans, they got down on themselves and against each other, and all of a sudden it was very easy for the Europeans to win. Differences, quality of player, differences, quality of experience this time isn't quite the same for the European side as it was 4 or 5 years ago. So it's going to be close. I think Europe is the favorite to win overall, but I think the Americans have a very good opportunity to end a 30-year skid here.
I also sense not only the fact that Wyndham Clark was able to handle the crucible of the U.S. Open so well, so phlegmatically, and so totally over those 36 holes, something that almost everybody in the media center thought was not going to happen. I mean, you know, just like same thing happened with Brian Harmon, people were openly saying he's not going to make it. Here comes the end. And it never happened. Okay, they never hit the chamber with the bullet in it. They never lost focus. And I think that it's that phlegmatic attitude that's going to help them, especially on the road. There's a bit of it's the world against us right now. And so sometimes it's easy for a visiting team to circle the wagons.
Yeah, and they may be able to circle the wagons around Justin Thomas because he's a controversial pick. Statistically, I would have liked to have seen some other players get an opportunity. Keegan Bradley probably being my personal favorite, but Lucas Glover certainly had a case given those last few weeks that he had, maybe not the whole season, but certainly the last few weeks in the qualifying period. And I think they kind of either have to rally around JT and they win because he's under a tremendous amount of pressure to perform, or they crumble around him because if he doesn't play well, then they start to wonder, well, who could have helped us? Who could have helped us with a point here, half point there? And it starts to get a little ugly. So I think he is kind of the fulcrum around which the American team will perform or not in Italy.
Good thoughts on that. I'm not 1,000% sure because you can't win a Ryder Cup with one guy, even if he goes 5-0-0. And you can't lose a Ryder Cup with one guy. Yeah, it can hurt you. Yeah, it can help you. But it takes a lot, and it takes a team. And more importantly than that, the one thing that you have to remember, you're not going to play perfect all week or all weekend. You just have to play right in the clutch. That's the key. And then what I've seen from Brian Harman and Wyndham Clark, they're not liabilities. I think they could be strengths. I think that they could be lions in sheep's clothing. Now, you did mention you saw some vulnerabilities. Where do you see vulnerabilities on both or either side?
Everywhere. That's just how this works, right? It's not. These are the best players in the world. Do not get me wrong, but that doesn't mean they're without weaknesses. And every player we talked about the best three players in the world between Rahm, Scheffler, and McIlroy. They all have weaknesses. It's when they show up. Do they show up at the worst time? And do they show up in what effectively is a random competition? I mean, we don't play this as a best of seven series. Otherwise, we'd identify the best team. So we do this with random blind draws, and we make irrational changes, sometimes rational changes, to lineups and teams based on the difference of format or what we saw 4 hours earlier. Those things are not easy to predict. You just never know. So in a contest of equals, this would be a really even matchup. And it may turn out lopsided. It may turn out close. That doesn't mean it wasn't a close matchup. It just means the outcome comes down to some things that are very difficult to predict. And that can create a momentum that is kind of hard to stop if it begins on Friday, in the right way. And if the Americans go out there and win the first session 3-1 or 4-0 or something like that, Europeans on their heels, make some changes, don't stick to the plan, feel the pressure, whatever it is, or it could go the other way. We could lose the first session very poorly as the American side and make some panic decisions, leave some players out, put some players in that was different than the original plan, turns out differently. Again, it's a weird decision tree that you go through playing this thing, and it goes in all kinds of different directions. So at the end of the day, it really boils down to who makes the putts and when, or who hits the right pressure shots and when. And that's the key to match play. It's all about timing.
You're listening to Jay Flemma Sports Report on iHeartRadio and on Golf News Network. I am Jay Flemma. We're talking with Ryan Ballingy, who's going to actually be at Marco Simone Golf Course covering the Ryder Cup in 2 weeks' time. Ryan, tell us a little bit about this golf course, Marco Simone. Who designed it? What's it like?
I don't really know too much about it other than watching the last couple of Italian Opens with it. It's an interesting golf course. It's a parkland golf course. Nothing particularly fancy or unique about it. Again, it kind of favors a longer hitter. All of the data that we have from the DP World Tour, from the times it's hosted the Italian Open, says it's a golf course that favors longer hitter. Well, guess what? That's every golf course. So I don't think that really tells us a whole lot either. I just kind of get the sense based on the layout that I've seen, Bob McIntyre's done well there, has won there. If you put together a lineup that hits it straight and far, you're going to win. Well, again, that wins everything. So the Americans have the strength in terms of distance from top to bottom, save for Brian Harman. I think they have the advantage there. The question is, can they hit it straight? And can they, as professionals, figure out how to play these greens, which aren't tricky. They're not particularly tricky. And see so if they can handle the pressure of 30,000 people each day rooting squarely against them, which is not something you usually deal with in golf. And it's a weird feeling to have people pulling en masse, not just here and there, but en masse for you to fail.
Well, there should be a lot of birdies then. It does look like the kind of course that they're going to set up for the fellows to be able to score. And so there should be plenty of drama and plenty of excitement. I'm getting plenty of drama and excitement. In fact, all the listeners are, by the way. Ryan will be broadcasting live from Rome, Italy, in 2 weeks, so everyone should stay tuned to that. And as all of you know, first I was in Argentina last week, and now I am at Sleepy Hollow, New York, enjoying the first round of the USGA Mid-Amateur Championship.
So that's it's a great time of year, even though the PGA Tour season is effectively done. I mean, we'll have the FedEx Fall that starts next week with the Fortinet Championship. There's still a lot of great golf to be played, amateur, professional, team competitions, not only the Ryder Cup, Solheim Cup the week before in Spain. We'll be there for that, which I'm very excited about. Then we've got all kinds of great golf on the DP World Tour in October and November. And then we've got the Aussie Double back in December. So always something to look forward to on the schedule. And Don't sleep on golf, even though it's football season.
Oh, no, not at all. We're going to see some wonderful golf courses besides seeing Sleepy Hollow, an indisputable masterpiece of Charles Blair McDonald, Seth Rayner, and then later on they added Charles Steam Shovel Banks, but also one of the great Tillinghast designs, Fenway Golf Club. The two courses are hosting the stroke play portion of the event, 18 holes on each course by the field of 264 players. And then a 64-player match play bracket, a long and grueling crucible. But that's what it takes to win a tournament like the mid-amateur or the amateur. You got to specialize in both. You got to play great in stroke play. You got to play great in match play. And you got to bring it every single day. Yeah, you're not going to play great every minute. Yeah, you're not going to hit every shot perfectly. But you have to play well in the clutch. And I don't think there's as good a match play venue out there as Sleepy Hollow is, especially this magnificent finish. The newly designed 14th green expanded 33% more with two large rails running through it diagonally, which caused all kinds of havoc on putts. The brilliant Alps hole at number 15 with its punch bowl green with severe slopes and a terrific defense in that you pin the perimeter. The glorious 16th, okay, was set over the dappled sunlight of the Tappan Zee and the Hudson River with its thumbprint in the middle of the green. And then the fantastic finish straight downhill at number 17 and straight back uphill to the clubhouse at number 18. Everybody who gets the chance to see Sleepy Hollow should. It's one of the finest clubs in the world. Anyway, you've been listening to Jay Plum's Sports Report. Ryan, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
And we will be seeing everybody soon. We're going to have Phil Pugliese and his lovely wife, Tricia, on to talk about golf throughout the country with regards to some of the ski areas, and in particular, the United States Ski and Snowboard Hall of Fame are having their golf tournament next week. And then Ryan's going to be back talking more about the Ryder Cup. So we will see everyone next time on Jay Flemma Sports Report on iHeartRadio and the Golf News Net Radio Network.